Hello, my name is Tony Reid. Welcome to GAY, a radio programme for LGBTI people and their friends on Coast Access Radio 104.7 FM and other access radio stations around New Zealand. Today you're getting another video, and you won't see it, you'll only hear it, but never mind, it's just somebody speaking, and it's an American video produced by somebody who calls his site Genetically Modified Skeptic. Skeptic with a K, it's an American spelling. These are a series of videos by an Andrew or Drew McCoy, who is now an atheist but was brought up as a strict evangelical Christian, and he has lots of pithy things to say about fundamentalists and the way they think and the reasons he was driven away from the faith. And the video we're going to play in a minute is called Awful Things We Believed at My Evangelical University. It is, of course, in a certain context, but it's of general interest in that such versions of Christianity are very influential in the US, which means they have infected evangelical belief elsewhere as well. For example, Billy Graham's son, Franklin, who is a big fan of Trump, was touring New Zealand a couple of years ago. Some idiot invited him. This talk covers a few topics. He talks about the attitude to sex in general, first of all. He moves on to discuss the nature of the education you get there, which is one of the most interesting points he makes. And he rounds up specifically talking about sexual orientation and gay rights. Anyway, let's play the video now. There's a lot of meat there to digest, so I hope you like it.
Recently, I had the chance to catch up with a friend from college. We got to talking about how our views have evolved since graduation, and we discovered that we both had come to view the culture of our university as highly problematic at best. That discussion has motivated me to share a few of the issues we discussed in order to shed light on problems within evangelical university culture. I also hope to reach others who have attended or are attending a similar university who may feel isolated in their acknowledgement of these problems. Those people need to know that there are others out there who see these problems as well. If that's you, you're not alone, you're not crazy, and you don't just see these problems because you have a prideful or unrepentant spirit. The school we attended was an evangelical Christian university. It was not a Bible college, but a full-fledged polytechnic university which placed evangelical Christianity at the center of its culture. I hope that you'll understand that I'm not naming the university here because I don't want any individual there to become a subject of public scorn. We had mandatory chapel 3 times per week, 5-minute devotions at the start of every class, and as a regular part of the admissions process, students had to sign a written statement that said they had accepted Christ as their personal Lord and Savior. Actually, pretty standard stuff for an evangelical university. Now, as usual, I have some clarifications before we go any further. The ideas or beliefs I'll discuss here were not taught primarily by professors. These things were taught in our chapel services and were widely believed among the students already because it was an evangelical school. To my knowledge, many or most students in other evangelical schools believe these things as well. So this video is not meant as a critique of my specific university, but of evangelical university culture in general. Finally, this is not a critique of the professors or academic programming of my university. This video is about culture, not academics. Now on to the first belief I'll address. Closeness to God is necessary in order to maintain sexual purity. Obviously, the evangelical take on sex is that sex is permissible only within the context of a heterosexual marriage. So, at an evangelical university, just about everyone there wants to have sex, but most think that if they did, they'd not only commit a grave sin, but also possibly ruin their chance of a healthy or godly marriage in the future. Inevitably, though, most, if not all, students acted on sexual urges in some way. By that, I don't mean to say that all students had sex, but rather that most made out with their significant other, engaged in what we called heavy petting, or just sometimes looked at sexually explicit material. Completely normal, healthy behavior for young adults. Boy, was it not seen as healthy, though. I mean, so many people at my school, myself included, suffered emotional breakdowns after having acted on a sexual urge, even though they hadn't gotten anywhere near having sex. And for those who actually did have sex before marriage, months, sometimes even years of emotional turmoil often followed. Most students' response to this turmoil was to pursue a closer relationship with God, who they hoped would give them the strength they needed to resist further temptation. There was a vicious cycle in play here. Students were expected to refrain from acting on normal sexual urges and were constantly encouraged to seek God in their lives in order to have His help in overcoming temptation. Then, when a student inevitably acted on their normal, healthy sexual urges even once, they'd feel an enormous sense of guilt and shame. Naturally, they'd spend extra time in devotional study and prayer, where they'd resolve that what we're taught in chapel and church is correct. We're all too weak and unrighteous to live up to God's standards. The only solution is to seek God more fervently than ever before, or else relapse into sin, which could ruin our lives. By the way, if a student was not ashamed of their sexual activity, but the university staff found out about it, they'd be required to meet with chaplains or advisors who would tell them to repent and seek God, or risk academic suspension. Obviously, though, reading, believing, and teaching the Bible wouldn't stop anyone from having regular, healthy sexual needs for the same reason that reading, believing, and teaching the Bible does not stop anyone from feeling hungry. It's just a part of our biology. Eventually, most students would act on their sexual urges again, and the guilt would worsen because they worked so hard to prevent that from happening, only to learn that they're still incapable of living up to God's standards. This was a crushing blow to self-esteem, which usually motivated even further devotion to God. The cycle would repeat from there, often continuing for the rest of a student's time at the university. With each repetition of the cycle, students' self-esteem would decrease. I can't tell you how many people I knew who fell into self-hatred, who constantly called themselves weak and unworthy of love, who struggled with self-harm and even suicidal ideation just because they continued to have sexual needs even though they were a good Christian. Don't worry, though, many of us were told, because even though you aren't worthy of love, God still loves you, and that's where you can find your worth. This cycle creates dependence on this form of Christian ideology. It takes a fundamental human need and convinces you that meeting that need is morally wrong. Then, when you inevitably try to have that need met, this ideology blames you and insists that the only way to stop acting on that need is to embrace the ideology even harder. This cycle becomes identical to a typical abusive relationship when the student's self-worth is found primarily in God's love, since God's supposed word has gaslit the student into believing that their own healthy human needs are the source of the student's problems. Closeness to God does not enable sexual purity, and believing it does can be extremely psychologically damaging. Once out of my evangelical university, I, like many others, have come to understand the teaching of this piece of Christian ideology for what it actually is: abuse. We should stand firmly by our beliefs so that education doesn't weaken our faith, but strengthen it. From a Christian standpoint, this makes sense. The most important thing in life is to maintain a relationship with Christ. Everything else is secondary. This presents serious challenges to the process of higher education, though. The goal of higher education isn't to allow a person to maintain all the beliefs which they held before they began studying. It's quite the opposite, in fact. Higher education, in part, aims to teach us what our most reliable means of inquiry have revealed about reality. Inherent to that process lies challenge to and dismissal of ideas which do not withstand scrutiny. Like I said previously, we were required to attend chapel services complete with worship and a sermon 3 times per week, and we began every single class, no matter the subject, with a brief Bible study and prayer. As if that wasn't forcing a narrative enough, we were also given countless assignments in various classes that required us to write about how what we learned in class affected our Christian worldview. However, the writing prompts were not usually worded so neutrally. They usually went something like, "How did what you learned in this class strengthen your relationship with Christ?" When you're required to sign a statement of faith for admission, required to constantly attend religious services to remain enrolled, required to participate in devotionals in every class, and required to complete assignments where the answer you're supposed to give is included in the writing prompt, you're not in an environment which prioritizes education. You're in an environment which prioritizes the maintenance of specific beliefs over education. That's indoctrination. If a set of beliefs is true, it can withstand scrutiny from any and all angles. There's no reason to be concerned that our beliefs may be challenged throughout our education if our beliefs are true. Why then, at evangelical universities like mine, were the students and faculty alike so fixated on the idea that maintaining faith throughout a university education takes some kind of special care? The fact is, evangelicals know better than anyone that today, the majority of people who attended a Protestant church regularly as a teenager disassociate from the church when they reach college age. That is an understandably terrifying reality to them. Some may realize that this is because the facts of biology, history, archaeology, and psychology do not support a literalist Christian worldview. Evolution is real. There was no worldwide flood 4,000 years ago. There's no evidence that large numbers of Jews were ever slaves in Egypt. Oral traditions, like those which served as the basis for the four Gospels, are well understood to mutate dramatically over even brief periods of time, and supposedly supernatural experiences, psychologically and neurochemically identical to Christian experiences, both occur in other religions and have well-known environmental triggers. I don't think most people at these schools realize all of this, though. Honestly, I can't tell you precisely why there exists a seemingly unanimous consensus that Christian faith withstands scrutiny, but also requires constant maintenance within an educational environment. The closest thing to an explanation I have is that cognitive dissonance is powerful, and when it's reinforced literally every few hours, the idea that there's any conflict in this notion just disappears. Commitment to a belief, regardless of what you learn, is not an ideological strength. And when that commitment is required for the maintenance of a belief, it's a sign that the belief is dependent on the believer's ignorance. If you get close enough to Jesus, you can stop being gay. This belief is an extension of the idea that closeness to God can help a person maintain sexual purity. Of course, students at my university who experienced same-sex attraction usually entered into the same cycle of seeking God to suppress their sexual needs, eventually acting on their sexuality, then suffering emotional turmoil and repenting, only to have the cycle repeat. There was a distinction drawn between gay or bi students within this cycle and all others within this cycle, though. For most students, their sexual sin was thought only to be an issue of the context of their sexual activity. But for gay students, any of their sexual activity in any context at any point in their lives was sinful. There's a big difference there. Most students were just being told to wait until marriage. Once married, sexual sin would be easier to manage. Gay students, on the other hand, were told that their only options in avoiding sin were to either remain celibate for their entire lives, which included refraining from even having any sexual fantasies, by the way, or to seek God so fervently that he grants them the elusive ability to turn straight. While there was already greater stigma surrounding same-sex attraction and activity than there was surrounding other forms of so-called sin, the few gay students I knew who didn't go along with the idea that they could turn straight or remain permanently celibate experienced social ostracization and sometimes even disciplinary action. The real absurdity of all of this is that this academic institution's positions on sexual orientation were based solely on anecdotes and were not only unsupported by, but actively contradicted by, the scientific data on the subject. That data is linked in the description for those interested. Oh, and my favorite response video I've probably ever done on my channel was a response to Frank Turek, a Christian evangelist, giving advice on how to respond to family members who have chosen the gay lifestyle. Yeah, he talks about God turning people straight, and I didn't take to that well, so go check that out if you're interested in that too. Countless times, the curriculum for my psychology degree at this university reinforced the idea that personal anecdotes, lacking any controls against confounding factors, served as less reliable data points than observations made within an experimentally controlled environment. Meanwhile, the university proudly ignored all research on sexual orientation in favor of the anecdotes of evangelists who claimed to have turned straight by the grace of God. In fact, the university even had Christopher Yuan, a so-called ex-gay Christian evangelist, speak in one of our chapel services while I was there. He told us the story of how he found Jesus while he was in prison and subsequently stopped living as a gay man. We students were expected to see him as evidence for the claim that God can change our sexual orientation. Because, you know, personal testimony is all we should need to believe that huge claim. However, during the Q&A which followed his presentation, a student asked a question which should have had an easy answer if God truly was in the business of turning people straight. The student asked, Now that you've come to God, are you sexually attracted to women? Christopher's answer, no. His answer had most of the audience looking around at each other in confusion. After several seconds of silence, he asked for the next question and just moved on. It was obvious, even with all of his talk of God's power over sin, the reality was that he had simply chosen to be celibate. So we at this academic institution were expected to forego any consideration of scientific research on sexual orientation in favor of a narrative which we were told was supported by anecdotes of great Christians, but was in reality still not supported by the experience of the most accomplished ex-gay evangelist to which we had access. The lesson of my reflections on all of this is that evangelical universities like the one I attended influence their students to purposely forego consideration of any information which could challenge their theological narrative, even though they teach within their own classrooms that cherry-picking data to support a favored conclusion is an anti-academic practice. The culture of these institutions asks students to maintain specific beliefs, even when those specific beliefs prove not to have the utility they promise, even when practicing those beliefs hurts them, and even when they have no intellectual reason to accept those beliefs. Upon this realization, it's easy to see why these universities require students to engage in such constant, repetitive Christian rituals. Without perpetual reinforcement, their theological narrative might lose its grip on their students, just as the church is losing its grip on those who attend secular universities. Thanks for watching. I've been Drew of Genetically Modified Skeptic. A special thanks to my patrons for their constant love and support. If you want to hear more from me, subscribe and follow me on social media at the handles below. As always, if you're an apostate in need, there are resources linked in the description to help you find community and mental health support. Remember to be kind to others in the comments, and until next time, stay skeptical.
So as I say, there's quite a lot there, and it's quite interesting. He has a lot of other videos. My favourite other one, which I won't play because we haven't got time, is called Three Christian Teachings That Made Me Leave the Church. And he talks in particular about the attitude to the neighbour, to your neighbour and who your neighbour is. And he quotes Paul's letter to the Philippians, which was a bit I can't remember knowing, so I'll just read it out to you. Just a couple of verses from chapter 2 of Philippians. There must be no competition among you, no conceit, but everybody is to be self-effacing. Always consider the other person to be better than yourself, so that nobody thinks of their own interests first, but everybody thinks of other people's interests instead. And I think that verse must be missing from Brian Tamaki's Bible, but never mind. And he said that when he tried to live that out, the older adults, who after all had trained him to believe it in the first place, told him to keep quiet and just violate the teaching and conform or he'd get into trouble. So it's not surprising that he got fed up with the whole thing. I think his arguments are very well put, and they echo my belief that fundamentalists value their dogmas over facts and truth, and that this approach has in fact infected the body politic, especially in the US, but increasingly elsewhere. Drew has provided valuable information supplying much background to this trend, which I wasn't myself entirely aware of, and helped me understand it more. Basically, education, research and checking facts are all bad for you if you're a fundamentalist. In other news, there's been one good development in the UK. The British Medical Association has issued a statement questioning the CAS review, especially the plan to ban puberty blockers for transgender youth, which the new health secretary, despite being a gay man, has leapt to carry out. But they've asked him to postpone, but generally came out with lots of critical questions on the whole report. They're looking at preparing a more detailed response. But their statement, interestingly, talked about consulting with experts, for example, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, which is PATHA in this country, and even trans people themselves, which is certainly anathema to Dr. Cass, who didn't speak to anybody like that. So it's good to see that not all POMs have been conned by that report, although there was an article really going full throttle attacking the BMA and The Guardian recently, the other day of all places. And meanwhile, The case of the boxer Imane Khalif is also of interest. You might well have followed this in the news. This is women's boxing, and she is a particularly good boxer, but she was born a woman and identifies as a woman. But there have been problems, partly because she was banned last year. I had found a good summary from Out magazine. Imane Khalif is a cisgender boxer, in other words, one who was born a woman and still identifies as a woman, who has faced an avalanche of hate, racism, misogyny and transphobia during this year's Paris Olympics after the International Boxing Association, the IBA, said she failed an unspecial gender eligibility test last year during a tournament. And there was an article in the Post, the local Post, recently, which didn't specify the IBA, but seemed to take it rather seriously. But, as is reported, the IBA is a disgraced organisation that was banned from the Olympics due to allegation of corruption and unfair judging, and is led by a Russian businessman with ties to the Russian state money, Umar Kremlev. Kremlev banned Khalif halfway through a tournament just after she beat a Russian boxer. Wasn't that a coincidence? No evidence of what the test was or what her results were have been given, and they've refused to give it. But TERFs like J.K. Rowling and Elon Musk, what a pair, immediately jumped on her with claims that she is a man beating up a woman. And you won't be surprised to know that that Trump and J.D. Vance also joined in this this cacophony. And thankfully, people are seeing through it. The IOC is very indignant about the whole thing. But it's interesting that this is, a cisgender woman who has managed to unveil a torrent of transphobic abuse and has been identified as a man beating up a woman by that well-known boxing expert, J.K. Rowling, no less. So the advantage there is that you follow through and find out about what is actually involved. And, of course, this has nothing to do with the fact that should women be boxing at all, or indeed should anybody be boxing, but certainly there are a lot of people who disapprove of women's boxing, but that is not the point here. To my great surprise, I've got about 5 minutes left, so let's have a little piece of music. This is nostalgic. I bought a CD of the soundtrack of the movie Rocket Man, all about Elton John. And so I thought I'd play everybody's favourite Elton John song, Your Song, sung here by the star who played Elton John, Taron Egerton. So, Taron Egerton, Your Song.
It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside. I'm not one of those who can easily hide. I don't have much money, but if I did, I'd buy a big house where both could live. If I was a sculptor, but then again, no, or a man who makes potions in a traveling show. I know it's not much, but it's the best I can do. My gift is my song, and this one's for you. You can tell everybody this is your song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's done, I hope you don't mind, I hope you don't mind that I put down in words how wonderful life is while you're in the world. Thank you. stop the Mars. Well, a few of the verses, well, they got me quite cross. But the sun's been quite kind while I wrote this song. It's for people like you that I keep it turned on. So excuse me for getting, but these things I do, you see I've forgotten if they're green or they're blue. Anyway, the thing is, what I really mean, yours are the sweetest eyes I've ever seen. And you can tell everybody this is your song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's done, I hope you don't mind, I hope you don't mind that I put down in words how wonderful life is while you're in the world. I hope you don't mind, I hope you don't mind that I put down in words how wonderful life is while you're in the world.
You can hear this program again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. or Thursday at 5 p.m. It is also available on our website at www.coastaccessradio.org.nz or just Google Coast Access Radio. This is Tony Reid for GAY on Coast Access Radio 104.7 FM and other access stations around New Zealand.
This program is made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.